Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show any time of day or night thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking about Circle of Stories, which is an event happening at the College of Santa Fe as part of the Bridging the Cultural Divide Beyond the Lecture series. Right now, I would like to welcome the folks who are going to be talking about the performance, Gracias a la Vida, Las Poetistas Amigas. Argos McCallum is here, Kieran Sequoia, and Andrea Lujan. Welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you.
Now, this is a performance happening at the El Museo Cultural. It happened a couple of weekends ago, and it's happening again this weekend for four days.
4 days, Thursday, Friday, Saturday nights at 8 p.m. and Sunday, 2 p.m. matinee.
Now, Las Poetistas Amigas are Latin American poets, five women. How did you choose, and the performances are in English and Spanish. How did you choose these particular five poets?
Well, Teatro Paraguas was founded about 4 years ago, and we've been doing both plays and Hispanic and Latino poetry using the theater arts to present the various poets. And we have seen such a huge, vibrant women poetry coming out, a tradition of women poetry coming out of Latin America, and we wanted to find out, where did this start? Who was the fountain? What was the source? What was the Renaissance or revolution?
And is there ever a source?
Well, there seem to be, these five women, Gabriela Mistral, Delmira Agostini, Juana de Abarbaru, and Alfonsina Storni, and Violeta Parra, all were born very close together in the late 1890s. They knew each other. They corresponded. They worked together. And they seem to have created quite a renaissance, and there are many generations of women poets doing very vibrant poetry coming out of Latin America ever since. So we wanted to honor these five women.
And so you're doing a performance which is not only reading of poetry, but really acting out and dance and movement and music and so on. There's five performers, four women and one man. Mm-hmm. How does it work, and what was each of your participation in creating how the performance of each poem went?
Well, it was a really interesting process because the director, Vali Rivera, is an extremely gracious director, and she allowed a lot of freedom in the creation process for each actor. So it sort of came to us organically, and then we moved the choreography and actually some of the scripting around what each actor felt. So it's a dream to be in this performance because we've seen it go from a concept to being performed, and it's all very integral to each of us. It's all a part of us. So for me, I'm more of an actor than a dancer, so I really wanted to focus on my performance of the poetry and to make sure that the audience felt what I understood from the poetry when I first read it. So it's excellent. I really enjoy reading this poetry and to depict the life of Alfonsina Storni, that's who I play, and to depict her life is fantastic. I consider it a great honor.
Well, tell us a bit about her life.
Alfonsina Storni was a poet, Latin American, and she had an extremely...
Argentine.
Yeah. Extremely hard life, and she sort of went through similar things to the other women in oppression and with her men and not wanting to be married, just looking for love. And she had a child, and she was always sort of looked down upon by other women in the community for always being different. But extremely ahead of her time.
For having had a child as an unmarried woman?
For that, yeah. And then also her ideas about love and her ideas about society, about her role in the world, and the kind of poetry that she wrote. She wrote very progressive poetry, specifically about men and women, their relationships together, and what she considered to be a normal relationship or a functional relationship and her
functional,
ideas of
love. Functional, that's such a modern term.
Yeah. But it's just she was just a very independent woman, and I really resonate with that. And she had a great affinity for the sea. She went to the sea actually to die. She drowned herself, And for me, it's interesting as an actor because I love the sea. So Alfonsina Storni is a very, very loose adaptation, I feel, of my life. I can draw parallels. And it seems that that's been that way throughout the play. Each of the actors can draw parallels to the character they play.
Would you like to read a bit of her poetry?
I'd love to, yeah. This morning I'll be reading You Want Me White, or in Spanish, Tú Me Quieres Blanca, and I'll read it in English. You'd like me to be white as dawn. You'd like me to be made of foam. You wish I were mother of pearl, a lily, chaste above all others, of delicate perfume, a closed bud. Not one ray of the moon should have filtered me. Not one daisy should have called me sister. You want me to be snowy. You want me to be white. You want me to be like the dawn. You who have held all the wine glasses in your hand, your lips stained purple with fruit and honey, you who in the banquet crowned with young vines made toasts with your flesh to Bacchus, you who in the gardens black with deceit dressed in red ran to your ruin, you who keep your skeleton well preserved, intact. I don't know yet through what miracles you want to make me white. God forgive you. You want to make me chaste? God forgive you. You want to make me like the dawn. Run away to the wood. Go to the mountains. Wash your mouth. Get to know the wet earth with your hands. Feed your body with bitter roots. Drink from the rocks. Sleep on the white frost. Renew your tissue with the salt of rocks and water. Talk to the birds and get up at dawn. And when your flesh has returned to you, and when you have put your soul back into it, your soul which was left entangled in all of the bedrooms, then, my good man, ask me to be white. Ask me to be snowy. Ask me to be chaste.
And Kieran Sequoia reading a poem by Alfonsina Storni, who died in 1938. A lot of these women... Argus, did a lot of these poets die young?
Yes. Delmira Agostini died at the age of 27. Her estranged husband killed her. They were in divorce proceedings, but she continued to see him in his boarding house room. He killed her and then killed himself. Alfonsina had cancer, and she had an operation. But it came back, and rather than face another operation, she decided to walk into the sea. She has a very beautiful poem called Voy a Dormir, I Am Going to Sleep, and that was published in the main paper in Argentina the day she was found missing, the day she killed herself. And Violeta Parra also committed suicide. She's the most famous for her song Gracias a la Vida.
Was that written as a song to begin with? It certainly is one of the most famous Latin American songs.
Yes, a lot of her work was in song form.
Did she write the music as well?
Yes, she did. She was performing publicly at the age of 12. Her brother Nicanor Parra was a famous poet. All of her children are also musicians. And she just gave so much of herself. She was not only a songwriter and poet, performer, but she was a ceramicist, sculptor. She was the first Latin American person to have their work shown in the Louvre. So these women were quite famous in their time. Gabriela Mistral was the first Latin American to win the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1945, ahead of Pablo Neruda. Who was one of her students in high school. She taught high school. A lot of these women were actually teachers as well as poets and social figures.
Now, Andrea, you play the role of Delmira Agostini?
Yes.
She's Uruguayan. Tell us about her life a little bit.
Well, as Argos mentioned just a minute ago, her whole life... was searching for that idealized love and for the purpose of creating like a superhuman race, you know, like the potentials of once you find that love, what that means for you and everyone else in the world. So I love that ideal. And but it's so sad because she was so young when her estranged husband, when her ex-husband took her life. But their relationship as abusive and controlling and unhealthy as it was, today, I mean, women put themselves in those situations time and time again. And
we just spoke yesterday on the air about a play called Baggage, which is stories of domestic violence in New Mexico. It's nothing new.
No, and I think it's wonderful that with Teatro Paraguas and Museo that we're bringing this to the forefront, you know, in a different medium through theater, because it's right there for you to see, and we're acting it out, but you know, it's happening in the real world, and these women's lives need to be presented.
Would you like to read a poem from Damiana Agustini?
Yes, I'll be reading Lo Inefable, or The Ineffable, and I'll be reading in Spanish. Lo Inefable. Yo muero extrañamente. No me mata la vida. No me mata la muerte. No me mata el amor. Muero de un pensamiento mudo como una herida. No había sentido nunca el extraño dolor de un pensamiento inmenso que se arraiga en la vida, devorando alma y carne y no alcanza a dar flor. Nunca llevaste dentro una estrella dormida que os abrazado enteros y no daba un fulgor. Cumbre de los martirios, llevar eternamente, desgarradora y árida, la trágica simiente clavada en las entrañas como un diente feroz. Pero arrancarla un día en una flor que abriera milagrosa, inviolable. Ah, más grande no fuera tener entre las manos la cabeza de Dios.
In this poem, she's talking about that creativity in her spirit, in her soul, in her heart, in her body, in her blood, that's just inside of her, and she's unable to let it out. It's stifled, whether it be with her relationship to her husband or people in her life or society, or all of those things. Her creativity, she never felt like she could really bring it out. And I think that's very true for a lot of us actors, actresses in this production, is we have so much heart and soul, and we're bringing it out with this production. And it's just one of the ways that we're able to help the community. And yeah.
Andrea Lujan, reading the work of Delmira Agustini, I saw just a bit of the rehearsal last night, and I was watching it and thinking so much about this question of, I mean, the different ways of experiencing poetry. So you can read it, and when you read it, maybe you hear it in your own head, or maybe you're really just seeing the words and thinking about them in that way. And then when somebody reads aloud, then you're really hearing it and the rhythms of it. And then when you're acting it, there's yet another dimension that you bring to it. What's it like? How did you decide? Because there's always that question of how much movement and energy do you bring to it, and how much do you focus on the words and let the words speak for themselves?
It's something that actually we still play with for every production, every night show. It's different in different ways. For me, I am a trained dancer, and so I want to put movement to everything, whether it's like shopping in the grocery store, having my cup of coffee in the morning. But for me and my character and for the poetry, it really is about these women's words, their work, what they were wanting to communicate through their poetry. And so I minimize the movement and let the words speak for themselves as much as possible. And when there are places that I find the movement could just help visually convey whatever the poetry and the words themselves are trying to convey, then that's where the movement goes. And it is different every time.
There's also Argos McCallum, a musical element in all of this.
Yes. Well, Vila Taparra, of course, we mentioned she is was primarily a songwriter, and we're very fortunate to have Jojo Sena Tarnoff performing with us. She's an accomplished musician with her husband Jeff. They have the group Melange. They play Santa Fe and different venues in the area. So, very much. We wanted to incorporate music as another element to give the poems focus. And
so does she actually sing Violeta Parra's music?
She sings about four or five of the songs. She also is providing accompaniment on the guitar and various percussion instruments during the performance, accentuating the poems. She also sings the song Alfonsina y el Mar, which is a very, very popular
That is a
song.
Heartbreaking song. I have sat in an audience and bawled during that song.
Yeah, so she does a very beautiful rendition of that, and we're very happy to have Jojo with us in the production.
Now, this is also a heck of a lot of memorization in what is perhaps not your first, Spanish was maybe not your first language, Kieran, and what about you, Andrea?
I am not a fluent Spanish speaker at all. And so that's one of the reasons I'm drawn to Argos's productions, is because it's another medium from which I can soak up the language, because it is one of my main missions in life to learn the language and to be able to read it and speak it and write it and understand it completely. So in this production especially, I'm learning the poetry in English and Spanish. English first, so that I understand what the Spanish is all about, and then it's easier for me to just memorize the words. It's a completely different process, and Kieran and I have spoken about this to each other.
Yeah, it was really frustrating for me, because in English, memorization comes very easily to me, and in Spanish, it's a completely different process. But it was also sort of fortuitous, because it really allows you to hear the rhythm of the poetry as opposed to the words. So when I read the poems all in Spanish for the first time, I wasn't able to understand the majority of what I was reading, so I could really hear the flow of the words and the way that Alfonsina had wanted them to sound, like just the sound of the poetry. And it does something completely different to your creative process to prepare a piece in a second language. And I was really surprised, really happy, that it totally opened up another part of creativity in my mind. It's fantastic. I really enjoy it.
Do you speak Spanish?
I speak Spanish a little bit. I understand it in speaking almost entirely, but the poetry and the language used in this poetry usually don't come across in sort of everyday language, so it's been a challenge for me, and I'm not bilingual.
Tell us a little bit about the other poets before we go, Argos, whom we haven't met yet. Juana de Ibarburu?
Juana de Ibarburu. She's from Uruguay. And she grew up, like almost all of the poets we're presenting, she had a very tragic first love. And she ended up then marrying a military man.
Tragic first love. Now, is that a requirement for being a poet?
I'm wondering. It could be. It certainly is a good jump start. They were posted all around Uruguay, but finally they were able to move to the capital, Montevideo, and her first book came out, Lenguas de Diamante, Tongues of Diamond, and she was an overnight success. She was accepted into the literary circles, the salons. She was like the rest of the poets. She was the only woman there. And in a way, her life, the tragedy of her life was that she was so honored. She was acclaimed Juana de America by the National Assembly in Uruguay. And she lived the longest. She actually lived till 1979. She was 86. And she published many, many books of poetry. But in a way, her creativity was stifled by too much recognition.
Really?
Which is very ironic.
So her early work was more powerful?
There was a freshness, a directness of her early work.
Is that what you feature in this play?
Yes, yes. And it's what we would call today feminist poetry. Basically, she was saying, don't trample all over me, don't put me on a pedestal, just treat me like a human being. And her poetry just resonated with every, you know, she became very, very famous.
Now there's a man in the performance who basically, I think mostly silently, plays the role of the man in each of these poets' lives.
Mm-hmm. That's correct. That's Rabajit. He's from Chile. He's one of our native speakers. He does do...
playing a non-speaking role.
Well, he does read some of the poems of Gabriela Mistral.
Okay.
We have four actresses on stage and five poets. So with the Gabriela Mistral, it's kind of an ensemble approach. All the actors take turns reading one of the poems of hers. She was quite famous. She, of course, as I said, won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1945. She had a very difficult life, very poor. Her father left her when she was three. She was educated by her half-sister. She became a teacher. That was one of the few avenues open for women at the time. But she had such an incredible propensity for teaching that her skills were recognized worldwide, actually. She was invited by the Mexican government in 1925 to come completely reform their educational system and set up public libraries throughout the country. She was also an ambassador from Chile to the United Nations.
And it's one of the things you hear about over and over again in the history of Latin America is the crossover between politics and poetry. We don't have a whole lot of that here that I know of.
No, that's particularly true in Chile. They like to honor their literary figures with postings to different consuls around the world. Pablo Neruda was posted to a number of spots in Asia and then also in Europe. And Pablo Neruda and Gabriela both worked together to organize a boatload of Spanish refugees to sail to Chile during the height of the problems during the Spanish Civil War. This poet-statesman is a novel concept in our country, but not in Latin America.
Well, the performance is called Gracias a la Vida, Las Poetistas Amigas, and it is at El Museo Cultural, presented by Teatro Paraguas, and it's this coming, well, tonight, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at 8 o'clock, and then on Sunday at 2 o'clock.
Sunday at 2 o'clock, that's correct.
Well, Andrea Lujan, Kieran Sequoia, and Argos McCallum, I want to thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Great, thank you.
And we'll see you at El Museo Cultural. Is there a telephone number for more information?
Yes, 473-0143.
473-0143. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break right now, and when we come back, we will be talking about Native American storytelling. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to talk about the Circle of Stories. It's an event happening on September 14th, that's a week from Friday, at the College of Santa Fe, and it's the first event in the annual Beyond the Lecture series. This happens every year, and this year's theme is Bridging the Cultural Divide. It's a set of free events. This one on Friday, September 14th, is at 7 o'clock at Tipton Hall, and I'd like to welcome Jill-Ann Spitzmiller. She's co-producer and director of Circle of Stories, a multimedia documentary website hosted by PBS. And she's a documentary filmmaker who's done all sorts of incredible projects. Welcome.
Hey, Mary Charlotte.
And joining us also by telephone is Melissa Nelson. She's talking to us from San Francisco. She's a writer, researcher, activist, and she's the executive director of the Cultural Conservancy in San Francisco, which is an indigenous rights organization. Welcome, Melissa.
Good morning. Greetings.
It's wonderful to have you. Let's start with you, Melissa Nelson. You are the director of the Cultural Conservancy. What is the Cultural Conservancy?
We are a Native American nonprofit organization, and we were founded in 1985, so we've been around over 20 years now, and our mission is to preserve and revitalize indigenous cultures and their ancestral lands. And we do this through a variety of means. We have environmental programs that work on sacred site protection, resource access, environmental restoration. And we have what we've really been focusing on the last several years are our cultural revitalization projects. One of them was the collaborative work with Jillian on the Circle of Stories. We also produced the film The Salt Song Trail, bringing creation back together, keeping alive the rich oral tradition and sacred song cycle of the Southern Paiute Nation. So those are some examples of our environmental protection work and our cultural revitalization work.
Now, storytelling is also certainly central to cultural preservations. In what forms and in what media are people transmitting stories to one another these days?
Well, what's exciting is it's really one of the most ancient original technologies for transmitting information. The oral tradition, you've got all the incredible aspects of performance. But today, Native folks all around the country and the world are using multimedia websites, films, audio recordings, television, to really do modern storytelling, what's often called digital storytelling. So we've been working with tribes and training groups and providing equipment for Native peoples to tell their own stories using modern equipment, but using a very ancient practice of sharing seeds of stories and maps of their land and spiritual lessons and hilarious examples of human foibles and human mistakes and ways to learn and teach the children. So it's a really exciting time for Native peoples in terms of the cultural renaissance that's happening right now, using this very ancient tradition of oral literature and storytelling and oral history combined with multimedia.
What is gained and what's lost in digital storytelling? I mean, there's certainly, when you're not face to face with the people who are telling you stories or whose stories you're listening to, it's a different kind of transmission.
Definitely. I mean, you can't beat the face to face contact that we're going to have with our event coming up at Circle of Stories. Really, storytelling always includes a listener and an audience and a participant, more than an audience, really someone who actively listens and participates and often becomes part of the story. So in that live performance, you've got body language and you have gesture and facial expressions and improvisation and spontaneity, things that musicians and other artists are well attuned to. So it's hard to beat that kind of live performance with storytelling in a group, which is more of the ancient tradition. But today, because people live far away, we're not living on our reservations. Over half Native Americans live in urban areas now. We are saturated with media, television. It's great to change the content of the things that we're hearing and seeing in the media with more relevant Native American content. So what's gained with media is access to these stories, even though you may be living in San Francisco or other urban areas where you don't have access to your elders and your traditional storytellers. So it's really giving a new generation of younger, mixed-blood, urban-based Indians access to some of these timeless stories.
We're talking to Melissa Nelson of the Cultural Conservancy in San Francisco, and the event coming up is on September 14th. It's called Circle of Stories, and it's in the Beyond the Lecture series called Bridging the Cultural Divide. To what extent is the preservation of native languages part of your work at the Cultural Conservancy, and to what extent are stories being told in native languages?
Oh, that's such a great, great point. I mean, you can't tell a native story really without using your native language. And sadly, a lot of native languages are very, very much endangered today due to forced cultural assimilation and many, many other historical reasons. But there's also a revitalization happening with groups like in Santa Fe, the Indigenous Language Institute, here in California, the work that we're doing with oral history and recording fluent language speakers, another wonderful organization, Advocates for Indigenous California Language Survival, where in California here, a lot of the Native peoples and nations have no fluent speakers anymore. So people are actually going back to the ethnographic records, the linguistic documents, working with linguists, and old wax cylinder recordings to hear again and learn, relearn these so-called extinct languages. What Native people are calling waking up sleeping giants, basically saying they're never extinct, they're just dormant. And from a spiritual perspective, we just need to respect and honor those languages again, and they will come back to us when we regain traditional skills like basket weaving or regalia making and dreaming in our own languages.
You talk about these old recordings. How were they? Who made them, and how were they preserved?
Well, it's very interesting. I mean, the whole field of anthropology, of course, has many, many problems with it. A lot of things were taken very, very wrongfully and unethically. But the fact is, anthropologists, ethnographers did do audio recordings with Native American fluent language speakers and storytellers at the turn of the century. And late 1800, early 1900s, as soon as the audio recording equipment was available. So, for example, the Ohlone tribe right here of the San Francisco Bay Area, they haven't had a fluent language speaker in probably 40, 50 years. But they're using these wax cylinder recordings that were made of their ancestors over, close to 100 years ago, and they're able to relearn and hear the language, the vocabulary, the syntax, the grammar from those old recordings. So they're being very, very helpful to restore the sounds of the language.
You can restore the sound of the language, you can learn to some extent the grammar and syntax. Can you really make it your own again?
Well, you can, and for example, this group of Ohlone people, they wanted to make something that was really exciting and interesting for their children. So they translated Dr. Seuss's Green Eggs and Ham into the Ohlone language. Yes.
That's one of my favorite books.
I know. And they put it into the Ohlone language. So now there's young people learning this language through these, again, new media, new tools of combining their language and their stories with other types of forms like books and websites.
Now, there are many different Native American cultures. They're very widely varied.
Yes.
And there's different, some of them as night and day. Is there any common theme that comes up in the stories and the kind of stories that we're going to be hearing in the Circle of Stories event?
Well, great. I think that's such a critical point. I mean, over 550 nations in the U.S. alone and over 100 in California with diverse worldviews and languages and customs and traditions. But I think one central feature is a sense of sacredness with the landscape and having holy lands and homelands that are central to indigenous identity. And I know that all of our speakers at our event will be speaking about the significance of our relationship to place, our relationship to land, and our relationship to the foods. And really, all of them, I think, share a certain quality of timeless lessons of cultural survival. And how do you survive in your local environment through foods, through medicines, through herbs, through song? And I think that's going to be a unifying theme that ties together our very diverse storytellers on our event.
And we're going to be talking to Lois Ellen Frank in just a moment about food. But I want to ask you one more thing, which is some stories are obviously lost over time. That's just the nature of life in all cultures. And some persist. Do you think there's any quality or set of themes or something that makes a story persist over many generations?
Boy, that's a great question. Obviously, that it is actively being used, and in terms of it's in the minds, it's in the mouths, it's in the ears of the people as stories that remind them of certain lessons from their culture, and it's usually tied to place. Certain mountains that you see every day have stories to them. Certain rivers have certain stories to them. So the persistence, it has to be an active thing. When stories are no longer used, are forgotten, clearly, you know, they disappear for a while or go dormant. But it's the stories that keep active, that the elders, the parents keep sharing them with their children, the teachers, the kids themselves bring them up and use them in their daily life as they're walking to school or talking with each other. So they have to be something that's very active in their daily life to keep them continuing over the long range.
Melissa Nelson is the executive director of the Cultural Conservancy in San Francisco, and she will be here. You'll be introducing the event, the various storytellers at Bridging the Cultural Divide Circle of Stories. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And we're hoping that a little later in the program we're going to hear a story straight from the mouth of one of the storytellers named Chin. But right now I'd like to welcome Lois Ellen Frank. She is a New Mexico-based chef, author, native foods historian, and photographer. Welcome.
Good morning.
Now, you, how did you get involved in this whole issue of food, Native American food, documenting food in the Southwest?
I guess it started, and I think this is happening globally, but many food traditions, if they're not practiced, let's say from a grandparent, if that next generation isn't taught a food practice, by the time you get to the grandchild, the potential for it to be lost is hovering around 90%. And this is true with language also. So what happens is if something's not passed down, then that parent can't teach the child. So from grandparent to grandchild, the tradition is lost. And many elders express this concern. So I took it to start documenting. And I don't know if you've ever cooked with grandparents, but they cook by braille. They cook with a pinch of this and a pinch of that and a little of this, a handful of this, and they really feel the food. And I think they put a piece of themselves into it. And Melissa was talking about connection to place. They put into a dish who they are, where they came from, how they came to be, the story of that family, the story of that cultural group. And so we started documenting recipes and foods with hopes that we could not only encourage the generation that's my age, let's say from 30 to 50, but the generation that's up and coming, those that are in high school and college, because as they become parents, it's imperative that they learn and pass it on.
Now, what is the role of storytelling in all of this, in the documentation of food that you do?
Well, in the food cycle, there's actually four components, and everything in Native ideology really goes in fours, but you have four seasons, and within those four seasons, you have the beginning, which is the planting, and then you have the spring field greens and the babies that you harvest, and then you have the summer, or the time when everything grows and you start to harvest, and then you have the fall, which is really about harvesting and preserving for the winter. And then you have winter, which is dormant, and that's when the traditions and the stories are passed on. That's when you make a stew and everybody sits down and you tell the story of the farm, of the plant, of the life of the plant, of the history of creation, of how corn was made into a relationship between human and plant, how things were cultivated, how wild foods are harvested. I mean, it goes on and on. So storytelling is a natural part of the agricultural cycle.
And corn plays a very big role in those stories as well as in the Southwestern diet.
It depends on the tribal group, but yes, corn is probably the most important cultivar, but I've sort of broken things down on what I call a food continuum. And the food continuum starts from 10,000 years to first contact in this area. So that would be all the pre-contact foods, including the cultivars. Corn, beans, squash, chilies, and tomatoes. And then you have first contact, which is foods that were brought in now that are 500 years old, which are still very native and very traditional. And in this area, that would include sheep, pork, beef, wine grapes, apples, peaches, and then you have...
Were the pre-contact natives vegetarians?
No. You had wild game, so you had rabbit, wild birds, there were prairie chickens, quail, some of the Pueblos ate robin, and then you had your larger game animals, you had venison, elk, and then we do know that turkey has been not only cultivated but released into the wild in this area literally for several thousand years. And then you had all your wild foods. You had your wild fruits, your wild greens, wild onions, wild celery, wild carrots, prickly pears to the south of us. Really just nuts, a bounty of all pre-contact foods. And then the last wave on this continuum, which has probably been the most detrimental and oddly enough the most iconic with native foods, is the Indian taco. And that pretty much is... When people were relocated to reservations, they lost their land base, they lost their food base, they weren't free to roam and harvest the wild foods, and so they were issued commodity or government issue foods, thus the birthing of the Indian taco, now which is iconic. And this may become the food of the resistance as native groups go back to pre-contact foods and their indigenous foods. Fry bread may become the food of the resistance, and we'll see, but that's my prediction, that there's an anti-fry bread movement because health-wise, it's hurt
really bad
the
for
community.
You.
It's not bad if you eat it two or three times a year at a powwow, but if you eat it every day and it's fried in lard, yes, it's not healthy.
I mean, diabetes is higher among Native people than just about any other group.
Well, I would argue that. I would say, yes, it's very high. It's also extremely high nationwide, and our food are contaminated. We have, again, corn, which was taken and twisted. Corn may have the last laugh in American history, but high fructose corn syrup, to me, is sort of the revenge of corn because it's in every processed food, and it's not healthy. And corn just grows and does what it's been genetically modified to do, which can be very healthy, but also in this sense, very unhealthy. And you're going to see type 2 diabetes in mainstream America explode. It's going to become the black plague of our generation.
Is there a movement against genetically modified corn in Native communities?
Absolutely. New Mexico has a coalition with the Native American Farmers Association and the New Mexico Esaki Association, which has gone to legislation, and they are trying to patent seeds in our state that say that it is illegal to take them out of their environment and genetically alter them. A good example would be the Chamayo red chili. It needs to remain pure in its essence without modification, and if you take it out, you can't say it's Chamayo chili. It can only be from the region that's in the name. You can't say Chamayo style chili, which would be the linguistic way around that. And so we're actually working on legislation to form protection for the indigenous seeds to this state and to make it illegal to plant any genetically modified crop in this state.
Will you be telling stories at this event next week?
I will, but the stories are going to be more about food and connection to place and how we learn from stories, the lessons that come from food, as opposed to this other issue of genetically modified and legislation. That's sort of another conference, but it is an important, and everybody should be really concerned and watching out for that. And another topic, but this is more about that period during winter when we share and pass down tradition and why foods are important, how they're important, et cetera. So those will be the stories that I'm sharing.
We're talking to Lois Ellen Frank. And do we have Chin on the line?
Yes, Chin's here.
Chin, wonderful to have you. Chin is a award-winning metalsmith, author, flute maker, educator, folklorist, and musician. He's also going to be here next weekend, the 14th of September. I was wondering if you had maybe a little story that you could tell us.
Oh, sure. Well, I tell you one about a coyote, and, you know, coyote's the trickster, and all kind of fun things happen, and the universe comes to be because coyote's misdeeds. But coyote was following a hunter who had just been very successful, and hopefully that coyote, would be able to get some of that good meat that hunter had just harvested. And so as he was traveling down the road and behind the hunter started to trot his horse, and as he started trotting his horse, a piece of meat did fall off, and coyote ran down there to get that piece of meat, and just as he was opening his mouth to grab that meat, bangs, right into his head, something happened, and he looked up and he saw there was possum and raccoon. All three of them were there, deciding that piece of meat was theirs, and they started to argue about who saw that piece of meat first. Well, coyote said, well, let's stop arguing and let's have a contest, and whoever could run the fastest would win that piece of meat. And the other animal said, no, that's not fair, because coyote, we know you can run the fastest. And raccoon says, well, I have an idea. Let's see who can climb the tree the fastest. And the other animal said, no, that's not fair, because we know that you, raccoon, can climb the tree the fastest. Well, possum said, I have a really good idea. Let's see who could have the best dream. This is a kind of contest no one ever had before. And they all agreed this would be great. So they all went to sleep, and they put the piece of meat up in the tree for safekeeping. Well, coyote woke up, and he woke up the others, and he told them that his dream was the best. And raccoon said, no, my dream was even better than yours. It couldn't have been as good as mine, coyote. And they looked at possum, and they said, possum, what did you dream? And possum said, I dreamt I ate a piece of meat. Ba-dum-bum. And there you go.
We're talking to Chin. How did you learn the stories that you tell?
Well, you know, as Native people, we hear what people call stories all the time. And it is always told to us that it would eventually become our turn to tell these lessons. And so we learn them through our lifetime. And as we tell these lessons and to other people, they give us the gift of a lesson, too.
Jillian Spitzmiller, you have co-created this website, Circle of Stories. It's an extraordinary website. It's more than just an informational place. It's actually, well, how would you describe it?
Well, Circle of Stories is at pbs.org/Circle of Stories if anybody wants to check it out. And my partner, Hank Rogerson, and I, along with Melissa Nelson and Phil Klasky of the Cultural Conservancy, we decided to make a place where everyone could access Native stories if they wanted to. And, you know, you asked the question before, what's gained and what's lost in this digital transmission, and it was really exciting to make a variety of stories accessible to everyone around the world. But I also was there when we videotaped them. We actually went to each storyteller and videotaped them, and the idea was to go to one person in each of the four directions. And so we just have a very, you know, small sampling. But, you know, and I was there in person hearing these stories as we recorded them. It was very exciting. And then they were put on video, edited into segments, and then an animator took them and put them into Flash animation for our website. So it was kind of a couple steps removed from that live experience. And so one of the reasons we wanted to do this event at College of Santa Fe was to regain that live experience, because there really is nothing like it. But on the website, however, we could put many, many, many layers of supporting information about what's the importance of Native storytelling to all cultures. You know, for me personally, as I grapple with global warming and climate change, and I want to get more into the roots of where I live, Native storytelling is so informative and leads the way for me as a person of mainstream culture to learn, you know, how do I get back to the land if I want to do that? And, you know, stories are told in humorous ways, in sacred ways. One of the people we're going to have for the evening is Hoski Benali, who's from Shiprock, and he's a Diné traditional healer, and he's going to tell a story about sacred medicines. Where did the five sacred medicines come from? And so that'll be a really interesting aspect of the evening as well.
Well, unfortunately, it's time to go. There's much more to talk about, but if people want to hear more stories, the Circle of Stories event is the Friday the 14th of September at the College of Santa Fe at Tipton Hall at 7 o'clock. It's a free event, and it's the first of the Beyond the Lecture series, Bridging the Cultural Divide, of which we are going to feature as many of them as we possibly can right here on the Radio Cafe. Jillian Spitzmiller, Lois Ellen Frank, Melissa Nelson, and Chin, thank you all so much for being with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. You can also find us at santafe.radiocafe.org. That's where we're podcasting. You can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz with John Greenspan features Artist of the Month, Michel Camilo. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow is Friday. The inimitable Robert Knott will be with us, and we'll also be hearing from the wonderful accordionist Dadu. So all this and much, much more on Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. Hasta la vista. Ciao.